This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This may be the ultimate in recovery stories. Dr. John Mooney was a surgeon who was addicted to alcohol and pills. His wife was addicted too. Dr. Mooney kept them supplied with drugs by writing out phony narcotics prescriptions. That landed him in prison, where he sobered up. His wife sobered up too. Soon he turned his practice into counseling alcoholics, and the Mooney's home became a clinic for recovering addicts. The Moonies had four children, three of whom were still living at home. You'd think the children would never go near drugs and alcohol after that, but three of the four became addicts themselves. My guest, Dr. Al Mooney, is the child who stayed straight. I'll call him Dr. Al, because that's what people call him in Statesboro, Georgia. Dr. Al is now the medical director of Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, the rehab hospital his parents started after they outgrew the clinic in their home. Dr. Al's father died a few years ago, but Dr. Al's mother, Dot, co-founder of the hospital, is with us too. All three of Dr. Al's siblings are sober now and have worked with the hospital. Dr. Al says that growing up in the Mooney house didn't seem so strange at the time.
It was a normal family as far as I was concerned. It was the only family I had ever been a part of, and I really didn't have anything else to compare it to. The first time I really knew that something was wrong, and I could identify that, was when my dad came back in sober. And all of a sudden, now I do remember confusion before that point. There was like a void in the family, but I didn't identify where it came from. But when I was 11, he was in a lot of trouble from his drugs, went to the Federal Narcotic Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, and came home sober. And it was like the same body with a different person in it. It was a very strange feeling. And he talked about what had happened. And he was not convinced he was an alcoholic or he was a drug addict, or at least I don't remember that. But one thing that he was convinced of, that there was something outside of us and the family that was responsible for a lot of this, and that he had been told there were some answers to it. Now, that was a relief to me because in some funny way, as the oldest child in the family, my dad was a doctor, my mom was a nurse, you know, very prominent in the community, and everything was going great. In a crazy kind of way, I had assumed responsibility, at least in my mind somewhere, for what in the family was not happy and fulfilling.
Did your parents try to hide their problem from you? Did they try to pretend like they weren't drunk or they weren't high?
I don't remember there being a lot of alcohol and drugs around. I remember one real bad argument that we had, and it was the strangest argument when I thought about it later on. We were watching TV one night, and I know now they were drunk, but I didn't, you know, the drinks were just around. I didn't recognize that it was alcohol. It was just, there were the drinks there. It was a big part of our life, and it was just normal. But one night, there was an argument about whether we should go to bed or watch TV. And about halfway through this tremendous argument, my folks switched sides in the argument. And they switched sides a couple of times. And the strangest thing that night, I remember both of them chasing me and my brothers up the stairs, you know, hurting us to our beds like animals almost. And then I remember them fighting that night. But I do associate the confusion, a little abuse, but not a lot. But the alcohol was just mixed in. I didn't know about the drugs until later.
Your late husband was sent to federal prison in Lexington, Kentucky, for writing prescriptions. What were the charges? Exactly?
Abuse of drugs.
Okay, and those were the drugs. I guess you were both taking.
Right. Right.
So he sobered up in a federal prison.
Yes.
How did that work for him?
I think it was the only time in his addiction that he had been stopped long enough, which I think is real important. He was there 4.5 months, and he was stopped dead. He could not get out. He could not do anything else. And he had to get involved in a program that helped him stay sober. And then when he came home, I went right along trying to help him. I didn't know I had a problem. See, that one of the most baffling things about this addiction is that we can nearly die and never know we've got it, not know what's wrong. I'd been to psychiatrist for years. I had even had electric shock treatments for years for my nervous disorders, you know, from living with the alcoholic, I thought. I still didn't know I was alcoholic, and I never got diagnosed as an alcoholic or an addict. But you can't when you don't tell the doctors that you drink or take drugs. I'd tell them how much he took, but I didn't ever tell them how much I didn't really know.
So when your husband came back from prison and he had sobered up, you stopped drinking and taking drugs too?
I didn't stop my drugs at that time, but I knew I didn't want him to drink. I was doing it for him. And I stopped drinking. I took my last drink before he came home. But the drugs, I didn't know there was anything wrong with that, and I thought I needed them. I did need them. That is my addiction, the need for them. But I continued that, and I went along with him, with the group we were in, and listened to the people, and I identified with those people, not only other groups, but I identified with the alcoholics and the addicts. And I diagnosed myself. And I haven't had a drink or mood-changing drugs since. And that was straight from the psychiatrist and the electric shock treatments and everything. And there weren't any hospitals then. There wasn't any place to go. All the women got put in the insane asylum. That had a lot to do with me staying sober, too.
Do you think the fact that you and your husband were trying to go through this together made it any easier for you both?
Yes, I do, because he had a start on me and had something to offer me, and he did not allow me in any way to interfere with his sobriety and what he was doing and the program he had going to stay sober. And I am grateful for that now, but I did not like it at the time.
How did he function as a doctor? And surgeon, too? Was he a surgeon, too?
I thought he was a surgeon.
Yeah, how did he function as a doctor and a surgeon if he was on drugs and alcohol?
Very well, until the very end. We had a lot of people in our hometown that said they'd rather have John Mooney drunk than any other doctor sober. And, you know, that's not good for an alcoholic, either.
Right, because it makes you feel like, hey, I can do this.
That kept him going a long time, you know.
But it's not uncommon at all for an alcoholic to excel and work tremendously hard at their profession, because they know that they're having to overcompensate in an area where their lives has fallen apart, or are falling apart.
And I was a great enabler.
How so?
I kept him. You know, we nearly loved each other to death, protecting and enabling each other. I would lie for him. I would do anything. I would give him drugs when he needed them, when he'd go into a hospital and they wouldn't keep him comfortable. I would take the medical bag and I would give him something to keep him comfortable, because they didn't keep him comfortable. And then if you stay with them, you need something too. So I would take care of both of our comfort while he was hospitalized.
Dr. L, when your parents started to sober up, what was it like in the house? Was it initially better or was it more tense?
It was really bizarre. It was a new family, a new life, new people that I had never known before. I'd always known them drunk. I describe myself like a little duckling that cracks out of its shell when, you know, when it's born. My whole life had been imprinted with that alcoholism, and now it was a very strange change that came over our family. And for the first year, maybe two, it was some of the hardest years I remember. I remember some of the, at home, you know, my mom was going through her drug withdrawal, and a lot of the hostility and a lot of the anxiety, all the emotions that she was going through were taken out on, you know, me and my brothers. The only real physical, we never had experienced a lot of physical violence, but I remember to this day, one morning on the way to school, it was like she exploded, and I curled up in a little ball on the front seat, and her fists were pounding me, and we've talked about all those things since and come and gotten okay with them, but it scared me to death. I did know there was something different, and I knew that there was, you know, I could see something that was different. I didn't understand it. It took a lot of years, and at that time, there were no family programs. There was no understanding of addiction, and my folks were gone off to their meetings and running around the country, beginning to take care of drunks, and it was like, well, first they love their booze, now they love their drunks, and where's the family come in?
So it took a while before sobriety seemed like a good thing to you.
Right. You know, I had kind of a love-hate relationship with it at first, but finally, I guess they got sober enough to understand what the family needed. And we began to do things together because there wasn't money to have the material gifts that we used to have. We finally got realistic, and my dad paid off the $600 milk bill that he had, and we did without ponies and toys and some of the material things that had appeased us for a while. But we began to take vacations together. The two things I remember doing was going to conventions of people who were also recovering. And also we went camping. We didn't have a lot of money to spend, so we would go up into the mountains and spend the weekends or weeks at a time camping together as a family, and some of those times I'll treasure forever.
Dot, how did you and your husband start doing recovery work and start bringing people into your home, turning your home into a recovery clinic?
Well, you know, one of the things that's best for alcoholism and in the early stage of trying to stay sober, and I think it's important on our own, is to help other people who are suffering. That's where I got some help from. And we just began to go places and meet people, and they would end up in our home because he was known as the drunk doctor, you know. Even after he got sober, they called him the drunk doctor because we were small town, and if they wanted to talk to find him, all they had to do was call the telephone company and ask for the drunk doctor, and they'd always give him the call. They knew who it was. And people started coming in, and there was no place to put them. So we just took them in at home, and it was good therapy for me.
Why?
As well as for them, because we would shell peas and butter beans and cry and, you know, just do all that crazy stuff together. At least I wasn't the only one. I had other people that were crying too, shelling peas and butter beans and doing whatever we had to do. And it was kind of nice, and it became normal for us.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Al Mooney, medical director of the Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, Georgia. It's a recovery center for people who have been alcohol or drug abusers. Also with us is his mother, Dot Mooney, who's the co-founder of the hospital and is in charge of women's extended care there. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Dr. Al Mooney and his mother, Dot Mooney. They run a center for recovering addicts in Georgia. Dr. Mooney is co-author of the recovery book. Now, you have three brothers and sisters, right?
Right. Two brothers and a sister.
Now, each of them got involved with drugs and alcohol.
Right.
Were you shocked? Were you surprised at all when your siblings started using?
I don't know that I've ever thought about that. That's a good question. And I think early on, I thought maybe they were just kind of playing the role. You know, our family now has an identity that's switched from alcohol to recovery. And I said, well, maybe that's just the way they think they can get their attention. And their love in the family was by confessing they've got an alcoholic, and then the family would give them their, you know, the love that they deserve like all these patients. And over a period of time, I began to, because when I went to college, we separated separated from my brothers and sister, and we were not very close at that time. I didn't have very much of a relationship with them. We had been pushed apart by the alcoholism. In the last 15 years, we've gotten extremely close, and we've gone back and talked about those days and become supportive of each other. And I'm amazed at what did happen. They saw all this. They heard all this. And yet the facts in their life involved with alcohol and drugs are so clear that they also had the disease of addiction that it's just irrefutable.
Now, how did you decide that you wanted to be a doctor and follow in the footsteps of your father and his father?
It really never was a decision. That's all I had ever intended to do. It was like I came from six generations of – I was going to be the sixth generation of physicians – the third generation in our community. I still have a few patients that my granddad delivered. I guess there are probably very few other physicians that have the kind of continuity in medical practice that I have and working with families over generations like this. But it was never a decision. I just knew that was what I was going to do. And I had some stumbling blocks along the way, and I remember being told a couple of times that, you know, people just didn't think I was going to make it. And I said, well, you know, I've got a contingency plan, and I had it all mapped out. And fortunately, it did work out. I was persistent and moved on through my medical education.
When you were studying medicine, did you plan on running a recovery center? Is that what you had in mind?
No, I initially wanted to be a surgeon, you know, like my dad and granddad. And then some strange things happened. See, every alcoholic I had ever known had gotten sober. I had never seen an alcoholic die that I can remember. I'd heard about it. But anybody who ended up kind of in our system or our network lived happily ever after. And I thought that was what happened to alcoholics and drug addicts. And then when I got into a medical training environment, when I got into real medicine, I remember at Emory when I was a medical student, we had a guy that I know now was in barbiturate withdrawal. He was very anxious and nervous. I didn't know what was going on then, except he had told a medical student partner of mine that he had been taking a lot of these drugs. He was shaking and nervous. I came back to rounds the next morning, he was gone. I said, where did so-and-so go? And they said, he died last night. And another person who was at Grady Hospital, where I was in medical school, had pancreatitis, came back the next morning. Where's so-and-so? Oh, he died last night. And I began to see alcoholics and drug addicts die, and it was a very strange feeling. I said, wow, this is something I can't believe is happening. These people aren't getting help. And then when I got into my surgery residency, we would do very strange things. I remember a patient who had chronic pancreatitis that every time he would go drink, he would go into tremendous bouts of pain and have to come back to the hospital. It was like he had a built-in reaction to alcohol that should keep him sober, and yet he kept drinking. Obviously, he was a bad alcoholic. But our solution to that problem was to take out his pancreas, give him a 95% pancreatectomy, which left him a permanent and irreversible diabetic and allowed him, I guess, to drink himself to death. I never knew what happened to him. And I began to think about what I was doing and what I had seen in my family and wonder, because there was no specialty of addiction in 1974, I began to wonder if maybe there was some way that my family experiences could ever be helpful in my medical career. And about that time, with what had happened at Willing Way, I was beginning to see that maybe there was a niche for a specialty of addiction, and that led to my decision to go into family medicine and then continue my work in the medical school and do a fellowship and then eventually come back to Willing Way as a medical director.
The whole family is involved, right, with...
Yes, out of my four children, three of them are alcoholic, and three of them are married to alcoholics, and everybody is sober and happy. And that's most unusual. But I think it's great because we all communicate, we understand each other. And, you know, we were talking a little bit ago about what did we do for people. Mm-hmm. I feel that loneliness is one of the biggest things with alcoholics, and the love that they get in recovery, I think is very powerful.
Dot, when your children became alcoholics, did you try to do something to intervene? You had already worked with a lot of alcoholics and drug users. Did you try to use your recovery knowledge to help them, or was it different for you with your children than it was with
other different
people?
I've learned that sometimes the families, we can learn what we can do about ourselves, but we can't stop them from drinking or taking drugs. And I knew that. And they, fortunately, the two boys just got help on their own. They admitted it, no confrontation or anything. They just wanted a better way of life, I think. Now, with the daughter, it was a little different. She had many treatments, and a lot of things happened in there. And I had to take a good look at myself because I was into denial about her. I knew it, but I know I didn't want to. And I had some anger about it. And I actually, I was enabling her. We both were. And that's something we knew better than to do. But we had to literally let her go and not even come home. And that's hard with your baby, especially my only daughter. But she says that if I hadn't done that, she doesn't think she would have survived. We were, when we cut her off completely, and that's hard. And I feel like I'm glad I was emotionally ready to do it when the time came, because I needed a lot of help during that time. It was really hard.
Let me ask you this. Now that recovery is so, such an almost like popular subject, for talk shows and books and so on, do you ever worry that, on the one hand, it's really increased awareness and it makes it possible for people to talk about what they've been through without being condemned for it. On the other hand, I know I sometimes feel like we've killed the language, that we've made everything into such a cliche that it's hard to talk about this kind of thing,
right,
and still sound, still have the words carry the full impact of the emotion and the pain and so on.
Right. We've dressed it up so until it doesn't sound so bad. And that's why I still call myself, and people laugh at me about this, I call myself a dope fiend, because that's what it was 31 years ago when I came in. And I didn't like that. That was a bad, bad, bad word. And codependency, that's a word that's become real popular. And, some places you don't seem to be in unless you've been in treatment for codependency. Well, I call it sick dependent. You know, being dependent on a member of the family is fine. But that sick dependency, I had gotten so sick with my alcoholism and addiction and was so insecure and so fearful of losing my husband that I wanted to die too. And me with three children, and that's sick, you know. And I still use those words that don't sound too good because I worked hard to get rid of those, that stigma. And I was the only woman I knew in Statesboro that was alcoholic, except one that I knew that said she was. But, you know, I'd been through all of the rout of shock treatments, electric shocks. I know all about living better electrically and learned all that. And that just didn't do it. It was not treatment for my addiction. Nobody knew I had it. But it sure did keep me alive until I found something that I could use for recovery.
I think in regard to the jargon and the movement of recovery, it's interesting that often when a new intellectual area develops or a new scientific area develops, one of the first things to come along is a new language for it. And often when we know the least about the scientific area, the language and the vocabulary embellishes it maybe in excess. Dermatologists, you know, we don't know where a lot of skin rashes come from. But if you've ever been to a dermatologist, you'll feel really great when you leave the office because you have all these long words of what the rash was. And basically, it all means the same thing. You know, they don't really know, but they describe the rash as it looks. And I think a lot of what we've heard in the recovery movement is just that. There's a lack of familiarity with this new emotional understanding, and people try to put it into traditional intellectual slots. And that creates a difficulty that comes out in fancy language and fancy words. And what I believe, and the longer I've worked in this field, the less necessary it is to use a lot of those fancy words. I can talk about love and hate and hunger and being drunk and high, and you don't have to use a lot of the fancy words that you hear.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
Great to share anything we can about this.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Al Mooney and Dot Mooney run the Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, Georgia. Dr. Mooney is co-author of the recovery book published by Workman Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.